First this hour to a man whose adult life has been transfixed by events, dear boy, to quote the memorable phrase of the late British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan. But this man prefers to live as an optimist and be wrong, and he'd prefer to live that way, than live as a pessimist and always be right. It's a French writer's sentiment reprinted by one of our great characters, Gareth Evans, in his just-published political memoir, The Incorrigible Optimist, which Bob Hawke will launch next week. I want to tap into some of that optimism because it certainly doesn't feel like the world is replete with the possibility of broad sunny uplands, Churchill's phrase, right now when you look at North Korea or the Rohingyas or the Middle East, or a sense that leaders aren't really able to prevail over uncertainty. So it's with great pleasure that I welcome Gareth Evans to Saturday Extra, even though he does acknowledge he's rarely seen the landscape so desolate for good public policy making. Nevertheless, he's pressing on, he says, always trying to discern the best prospects for peace and for the best positioning of Australian foreign policy, about which he has much to say, as he did during his 21 years when he was a politician sitting in the Hawke-Keating-era government. So, Gareth Evans, welcome to the program.
Hi, Geraldine. Great to be back with you.
You also use, it's full of quotes, I must say, your book, the immortal Samuel Beckett quote, "Ever tried, ever failed, no matter. Try again, fail better." I love that. I do wonder, though, Gareth, if we are failing better at the moment.
Well, always looking on the bright side does lend itself to parody, as fans of Monty Python hardly need reminding. But I do think when you look at things in a broader perspective, there are always grounds for a degree of optimism, however much horror and catastrophe seems to be unfolding around you. I mean, take what we're seeing with Kim Jong-un in Korea. Despite the oddness, eccentricity, ugliness of so much of his behaviour, despite the anxiety it's generating, if you look at the longer term stretch and the way this issue has evolved, and what this character is all about is regime survival, and he knows that to fire the first shot is to be homicidal, is to be suicidal. In the case of Trump, as disconcerting and anxiety generating as this character is for so many people, we are beginning to see an incredible degree of pushback from the American system as well as internationally, and people are just demonstrating a significant lack of tolerance for the kind of ignorance, narcissism, lack of judgment, ethical waywardness that Trump so obviously represents.
So you think it might force people to re-examine some of their own nostrums?
Yeah, well, pendulums do swing. The wheels do turn. And even the most serious cases, the DTs, we are capable, I think, of overcoming them. I mean, I think the important thing, and the thread that runs through my own sort of public life, I guess, has been the belief that if you are pessimistic, that's incredibly self-defeating. You don't even try. You just retreat into a crouch. You build, in foreign policy or defence terms, big walls around you. And you don't even believe in the possibility of better outcomes. If you're an optimist, you are always willing to push the envelope, to try harder, to be prepared to fail, but in order to get an achievement at the end of the day. And I've had enough experience of dealing with sort of intractable international problems, from the Iran nuclear one through the Cambodia problem all those years ago, to believe that if you do work away at these issues and maintain that spirit of the art of the possible, then big things are achievable.
Well, I can only imagine the diplomacy that is underway at the moment behind the scenes in terms of the US and China and North Korea. I mean, I wonder what you and the UN, because you do discuss this quite a lot, I wonder what you think, where would you be putting your energies at the moment?
Well, I think the solution to the Korean thing, or the approach to the Korean thing, has to have sort of three legs. One is obviously containment. The second one is obviously deterrence. And in that context, Trump's threats to turn North Korea into a car park if there is any aggression from the North, while over the top in rhetorical terms, are nonetheless substantively perfectly sensible message to communicate. But the third leg has to be keeping the door open for negotiations. And I think the reality is, because the regime is so fixated on its own survival, it is possible to contemplate a scenario evolving where we can at least get a freeze in terms of its current missile and weapons development activity. We were very close to getting that in the mid-90s, very close again when negotiations in which I was involved as Australia's foreign minister. We're very close again in the mid-2000s. We keep on blowing it. As much to blame on the Western side as on the North Korean side, because we're asking too much, expecting too much. But I think it is possible, with some help from China. We're not going to get China exercising all the muscle that it's capable of applying in terms of food.
You don't think?
No, in terms of food and energy supplies and so on, which people keep saying the Chinese are capable of doing, because they're very, very concerned about implosion in the north and all the implications of that for destabilization of their immediate region. And they've got some obvious anxieties about the US getting too close to their border should Korea reunite on South terms. So there's a lack of degree of will, I suppose, on China's part to push things really a long way, and there's a lack of capacity to push the thing to final conclusion. It's time for a Bex and a lie down, I think, in terms of this whole situation. The rhetoric has escalated out of control, and the real worry is not that anybody's going to do anything deliberate to initiate a conflict on either side. The real worry is impetuosity and overreaction to provocation and misperception of the communication flowing from that, and some aircraft of the US flying too close to Korean shores. They're believing there's a bomb attack underway and retaliating accordingly, and then sort of escalation. That's the yes. Nightmare scenario. But, if we just step back a bit, de-escalate the rhetoric, focus on the main game of trying to neutralise the threat through some degree of effective diplomatic negotiation of the kind that's proved possible in the past in so many of these intractable situations. I think the way forward is reasonably okay.
You do quote the second Secretary General, Dag Hammarskjöld, who died in a plane crash, is saying that the UN was never designed to bring us to heaven but to save us from hell. Do you think it is playing a useful role at the moment?
Well, the UN's a bit of a bit player in the Korean situation, but it's not a bit player in many, many other situations around the world. And I think people don't fully appreciate the extent to which that UN engagement in peacemaking, in peacekeeping, and in post-conflict crisis peace building has in fact generated a far less violent environment over the last couple of decades than we've been used to for previous decades, in fact previous centuries. It's been a pretty spectacular achievement. Obviously there's catastrophic counterexamples, with Syria being exhibit number one, and still obviously anxiety in a number of other locations. But the overall pattern in world history has been one of a fairly dramatic diminution of violence at all levels, within states, between states, in terms of human rights violations, everything else. We're totally consumed with the headline of the moment and the catastrophe of the moment, and I don't for a moment suggest that all is well in the garden. But if you do take that longer-term perspective, I think it does give you the confidence to keep on trying for solutions rather than just pulling the covers up over your head and building those big defensive walls and hoping that it all goes away. You've got to keep trying.
Yes, well, it is a central part of your book. Gareth Evans is my guest today, whose new work is An Incorrigible Optimist. Now, there's so many stories in this book that it is really great fun, I must say. I've just got to read the one on page 186, where you make the point that you'd embarked with mixed success to Russia to strengthen economic and political relations with Russia. And there was a memorable encounter, though you didn't appreciate at the time just how memorable, in St. Petersburg in November 1991, to meet the mayor, who actually was quite influential at the time, but he couldn't come at the last minute. And so, in fact, you and a group of senior officials and businessmen were pretty underwhelmed by the sort of turn of events, particularly when it became clear that the deputy in question who was sent to meet you, a young blonde-haired gentleman with high cheekbones and steely blue eyes with minimal interest in Australia, had nothing to say to us, manifestly even keener than we were to bring the whole unproductive event to a conclusion. And you concluded proceedings by saying, "What an absolute pleasure it has been for us to have you with us today, Mr. Putin." Now, that is truly, that's an amazing thing to hear.
Yeah, well, be nice to people on the way up because you never know who's going to be at the top of the pile. And we were deeply underwhelmed with each other across that particular table. And what an opportunity lost when you look at the way history subsequently evolved.
He certainly is an amazing character to consider, isn't it? And I mean, he's another wild card that you couldn't. I suppose this is what makes the whole arena so fascinating for you, that you couldn't have. Well, maybe you could have predicted someone like Putin to come out of the old Soviet Union.
Well, you couldn't have predicted the precise course of events. I mean, it is incredibly extraordinary, as Harold Macmillan once said, you know, as you quoted at the beginning, what's his greatest challenge in government? Events, dear boy, events. And things do come at you. I mean, Putin's a very, very interesting character. I mean, he's a nationalist. He's an old czarist in many ways. He's an authoritarian. But how dangerous is he? Well, you know, he's obviously pushed things to the limits in Ukraine and with Crimea and so on. But the notion of him marching across the border into Latvia or the other Baltic states or generating a major dust-up, you know, with NATO is really pretty inconceivable. This is a guy who knows the limits, and this is a country that has its limits. It might have 7,000 nuclear weapons, which is a little bit troubling. But just remember, I mean, Australia's GDP is higher than Russia's.
Yes, you did.
Put things into that kind of context, and you know, the capacity of Russia under Putin to restore world, you know, dominance aspirations is just, you know, inconceivable. So
he's played his foreign policy very well, you would say, and this is what I want to come to now. You're in completely preoccupied with how we position ourselves and as a good and useful middle power. You have three clear prerequisites for good Australian foreign policy for the future: more self-reliance, more Asia, less United States. Now, why put it like that?
Because I think we've been too obsessed for far too much of our history with the great and powerful friend syndrome and the belief that that's what we need to bail ourselves out of any trouble at all. I'm the last person in the world to want to walk away from the US alliance. I'm fully conscious of the benefits it gives us in intelligence and logistics support and the deterrent reality of having a big power there, which is at least notionally committed to coming to your defence. But the United States has made so many mistakes in the past. We've followed them down so many cul-de-sacs and rabbit holes. Iraq in 2003 being the most spectacular example, but go back to Vietnam and many others as well. And the prospect of them going down even more such rabbit holes with the Trump administration is not one that inspires confidence in putting all your eggs into that particular basket. So I'm not saying no US, I'm just saying less obvious reliance on the US to be our great protector, to recognise that our history does lie, our future lies with our geography rather than our history, and to recognise that you know, the relationships around Asia are going to be the crucial ones. And I'm not just talking about getting right our relationship with China, our biggest economic partner, but obviously also with India, the Japan, and above all with Indonesia and the ASEANs. We just have to create a much stronger sense of bonding and common commitment and common engagement on these issues, because that's where our future lies. And more self-reliance means, you know, just a willingness to recognise that, you know, defence capability is something you've got to pay for. And, you know, under Kim Beazley and I, when we were back there as Foreign Minister, Defence Minister, we were, you know, besotted with getting that part of the equation right. And I'm not sure that we're doing it as well as we should these days.
Are we playing enough golf? You do make the point that a lot of diplomacy is conducted on golf courses, particularly in Asia.
Yeah, well, the funny thing about golf is you don't actually use those occasions to talk matters of high state. You tend to talk about golf and what a lousy shot you've just made or they've made. But the bonding that's involved, the sort of the personal relationships, the degree of comfort that you develop. I mean, I tell the story in the book about going into, during the course of one of those big Cambodian negotiations, great big conference in Jakarta, and during a coffee break looking for a private room to make a phone call, I inadvertently stumbled into a group of my ASEAN colleagues. About half a dozen of them were sitting having a coffee together, and I immediately made profuse apologies. Sorry guys, didn't mean to intrude. And one of them said to me incredibly memorably and incredibly movingly, come on in, Gareth, you're one of us. Mm-hmm. You're one of us. And I mean, I just found that an incredibly encouraging and almost exhilarating demonstration of, you know, where we could get to if we worked very hard at developing these relationships with our Asian neighbours and took each other seriously and worked together to meet the common threats, economic, military and otherwise, that are clearly going to be there in the future.
I just have to add one of the funniest stories also. You talk about the difference, though, the difficulties, though, in cross-cultural communications in diplomacy, and you quote an occasion when a celebrated early hawk speech to a business audience in Japan, when he gave an assurance of sincerity that he would not play, quote, silly buggers with them, was rendered by the bemused interpreter as laughing homosexuals.
Which had a lot of very stony-faced Japanese scratching their head, what the hell is he on about?
Look, I just want to, there's a lot we could go. I just want to play you something that, because you also talk about the nature of leadership and how personalities and people do matter in the course of events, even though we sort of tend to think, oh, forces just overwhelm them. And Brett Stevens, the New York Times columnist, gave a speech at the Lowy Institute last week. He questioned the optimism that Trump might be impeached or won't serve a second term and warned us all to be careful. Here was his reasoning.
Don't be surprised if Trump wins a second term. And the reason I say this is we just had a quarter with 3% growth. And 3% growth forgives a great many tweaks. Unemployment is very low. The labor participation rate is rising. People become accustomed to a kind of clownishness. There's a sort of defining deviancy down sort of quality. And if the economy is thriving, it's very hard to defeat an incumbent president, particularly given the total disarray of the Democratic Party. One of the ways in which Trump is most effective is that he has driven Democrats insane. And the Democratic Party ought to be recovering its centrist instincts of the Bill Clinton variety, and it should be a party that is addressing the needs of middle-class Americans.
So that touches the, you know, some of you, several of your obsessions, politics and the nature of why it's worth being in the game and whether there's a sense of people having confidence in the people who are leading them. And you do identify this as a major issue in times to come.
Yeah, I think the significance of what Stevens is saying there is about the absolute necessity of the Democrats in opposition to get their act together and to provide both a decent storyteller to lead the charge against this narcissistic ignoramus and also a decent storyline, and a storyline which is receptive to the concerns and anxieties, whether they're economic, whether they're cultural, whether they're security, of people out there. And if you can't develop an attractive storyline told by an attractive storyteller, you do become a prisoner of people like Trump, who are passionate enough in terms of their support base to get out the vote. The biggest problem in a country like America, which mercifully we can avoid here, is the switch off factor and people not even coming to the polls. And that's what lost it for Hillary Clinton. Mm. That's what lost it for the Remain campaign in Britain. One of the many mantras in my book is that old line from Joe Hill, you know, the International Workers of the World, the wobbly union organizer back in the early years of the 20th century, when the night before his execution on a trumped-up charge in Utah, wrote to his supporters, "Don't mourn, organize."
Yeah.
"Don't mourn for me, organize." And I think that's the message. If you opt out of politics, you end up being a prisoner of the crazies like Trump.
Well, now, just before I let you go, we've got one text here from Pat in Clunes. "Evan's well-recorded hostility, even abuse of the Greens, gives the lie to any notion that he's an optimist who's capable of orchestrating solutions."
Well, the Greens are a bit of a problem. I've got a lot of affection and respect for people like Di Natale, who I think is absolutely genuine. But so often in their history, for the Greens, the best has been the enemy of the good. And I, for one, will have great difficulty ever forgiving them for their vote on the emissions trading scheme and on the Malaysian plan for the settlement of refugees. It's all terrific to be an idealist, as the Greens so obviously are. But you've got to translate that into effective pragmatic politics, and too often they've just gone missing when that's been on the table.
One tweet has come through. "Silly buggers." All right, Gareth Evans, thank you. Look, there's lots more, but we have to stop. Thank you for your time. Congratulations.
Thanks, Geraldine. Great to talk to you.
Gareth Evans, whose book is Incorrigible Optimist, a political memoir. It's a Melbourne University Press publication, and watch out for some more coverage of his book next week. There's a lot in it. If you're at all interested in politics, there's a lot in it.